This is an interview with Stephen Spencer, who worked in the press gallery at Provisional Parliament House from 1986 to 1988, and subsequently at the Australian Parliament House from 1988 to 2001. From 2001 to 2005, he was speechwriter and press secretary to Simon Crean. He has continued to work in the press gallery since then. Stephen will be talking with me, Edward Helgeby, for the oral history programme conducted by the Museum of Australian Democracy at Old Parliament House. On behalf of the director of the museum, I would like to thank you for agreeing to participate in this programme. Do you understand that the Commonwealth owns copyright in the interview material, but disclosure will be subject to any disclosure restrictions you impose in completing the rights agreement?
Yes, I do.
This being so, may we have your permission to make a transcript or a summary of this recording should we decide to make one?
Yes, certainly.
This interview is taking place today on 20 February 2014 at 11:30 a.m. Can we begin with a bit of background on your parents? What did they do for a living? How did they influence your course of life, and when and where were you born?
Okay, I was born in Manchester, in Britain, in 1963. My father and my mother both left school at 15, but both were very big believers in education. They hadn't been given that opportunity because their families basically required them to leave school as soon as they could and work. So it was always a big pressure from my parents to finish high school, go to university, get an education. It was something they drove in me. We emigrated to Australia in 1969 under the Assisted Passage Scheme, or £10 POMS as it was known. And the Australian government paid the fare of migrants to Australia, and I came to Australia with my parents, one of my brothers, and my mother's parents. We all came on the same ship, which was the SS Arawa, ARAWA, Shaw Savile Line, which was a ship that was specially built, I think, to run this route. But it only was around for a few years. About then, air travel was already starting to take over, and the liners to Australia were just about finishing. We were amongst the last people who came out, I think, on liners. We had a six-week voyage to Australia and arrived in November 1969. I grew up in Sydney, in the northern beaches of Sydney, at a place called Newport. I went to Newport Primary, Pittwater High School at Mona Vale, and then Macquarie University in Sydney, where I got a Bachelor of Arts degree. I got into journalism because from a very early age I was fascinated by news. I loved news. I loved watching the news, reading the newspapers, listening to it. I don't know if that was necessarily encouraged by my parents. It was not something that they were into, but they were people who were interested in events of the day and politics. So we always had newspapers around the house. We always had the television news on, and that was just something I became fascinated with and always wanted to be a journalist.
So you were always driven for that
from about the age of 10. Path. Yes, yeah, I was quite lucky in that. I wasn't one of those people who never quite was sure what they wanted to do. I knew all along and had a goal in mind, which was to get to university, get a certain mark that would get me into a certain university, to get me a course, to get me to be a journalist. And I got the marks I needed. I got into the course at Macquarie University, which was a Bachelor of Arts in Mass Communication. Not really journalism. There were very few journalism courses in those days. And then when I finished the degree in 1983, I applied for cadetships with all sorts of organisations. I missed out on a lot of cadetships, strangely, because in those days having a university degree was seen as a negative. Most newspapers regarded you as being too smart and would use too many big words, so I missed out on a cadetship. News Limited rejected me, even though I passed all their trials and got right through to the final selection phase. The reason I was not given a job was because I was told I had a degree and would use too many big words. Whereas now it's the other way around. Now, of course, you can't get into journalism unless you do have degrees.
Do you mention in the notes you've given us that you got a job with 2CH?
Yes, so I was about 6 months after I worked in a supermarket while I went for every job, 120 rejection letters, and I went for a job with 2CH, which was then an independent music station in Sydney, played what would you call it, wallpaper music, just sort of background music, very light and easy, I think was their slogan. But they had a very good newsroom. They had 7 or 8 journalists. They were very serious. Their audience, while it listened to background music, liked news to be straight and very serious news. They liked it done in a proper fashion, a sort of an ABC style. And I went for a job there. It came down to two people. The other person got the job, but 6 weeks later, that person quit because they didn't like it. And I was contacted, and I started in May 1984. And I had 18 months in Sydney working for them. As in radio, you do everything. There's very little specialisation. It's more what hours of the day you're working. So I did court stories, I did political stories, I did crime stories, I did just whatever was the story of the day. So I covered, for example, the trial of High Court Justice Lionel Murphy when he was charged with corruption. I was at his court. I also covered the Bikie massacre when that happened. I was on duty that day and went out to Milperra to cover the shootings that had happened there. I can remember covering a plane crash. I can remember covering some of the problems. Neville Ram, when he was Premier of New South Wales, I went to a number of his. So you got a little bit of everything. But the thing that I was always passionate about was politics. I loved politics. Nice. And in January 1986, 2CH became part of a slightly wider network, the AWA network, which had stations in Melbourne and Perth, and they needed a proper Canberra bureau. And I was 22, and they asked me whether I wanted to do it, and I jumped at the chance. It was my dream to work in Canberra to be a political reporter, so I came here.
So this was where did you live in Canberra, and what was it like at that time?
I lived in Downer. It was probably just starting to become a significant city then, but there wasn't the big, you know, there was the Monero Mall in the city, but you didn't have the big Canberra Centre. I remember if you wanted to do any significant shopping, you still had to go probably out to Belconnen, was the Westfield at Belconnen, or even to Queanbeyan. The Monero Mall, whatever it was at Queanbeyan, were still bigger shopping centres than the centre of Canberra. So it was still very, there was still only, the only TV stations were ABC, Capital and SBS. That aggregation hadn't happened, so you still didn't have a lot of choices of television. There wasn't a big cinema in the city. You had, I think there's one or two. So it was still quite a small town. It still felt like a small town, even though there probably would have been 200,000 or 300,000 people then. You still had not, a lot of the shops didn't exist. There weren't many cinemas. There wasn't a lot of television. There was no FM radio. You still only had 2CA and 2CC then, and the ABC. So you had very few choices in that sort of regard. And the one good thing was there was still, even then, though, lots of restaurants and cafes. The fact that politicians and diplomats were here meant there was always good places to eat.
You mentioned that you actually came to Canberra to take up this job. My impression was that you worked for Rob Chalmers inside Canberra. Was that part of that organisation?
Yes. What happened was 2CH, because it didn't have a Canberra bureau, it paid Rob Chalmers to provide them with a pretty basic service. That consisted of Rob Chalmers Senior, his name was, doing some editorial commentary for 2CH, which ran every afternoon. I think they called it the Rob Chalmers Report. And his son, Rob Chalmers Junior, provided a pretty basic coverage. He would cover the major political stories and send them some audio of the Prime Minister or the opposition leader talking. But he wasn't a trained journalist. He just worked for his dad and sent them stuff. So when they decided to properly do it, the problem, as you know, in this building, space was at a premium. Nobody had any room whatsoever, so 2CH couldn't come down here and set up an office because there was no room for them. So I was put in the corner of Rob's office, which ran, a whole bunch of people were in there. So T. Max Hawkins was in there, Jenny Hutchinson, who was, I think, Rob's wife at the time, was in there, Rob Chalmers, Ken Randall was in there. And what there was a whole series of newsletters, the primary industry newsletter, T. Max Hawkins' defence industry newsletter, Rob Chalmers' Inside Canberra, Ken Randall, I think, did a Pacific Islands report. And these were fantastic little four-page sheets, which what happened was they would just pick up every bit of information from the building, press conferences, press releases, announcements, debates in Parliament, and put them in as little, as you've seen in Inside Canberra, just little briefs about everything that was going on. And people subscribed to these newsletters. It was the days before the internet, so people didn't know what was happening in this building often that affected their jobs or their industry. And so Rob and his friends set up this organisation which basically provided specialist newsletters to defence, to farmers, to which would just say, there's nothing particularly special about it, but if you hung around the building, you would know all of these things. And they had a massive readership.
What's your job?
Well, I didn't work for them. So I was in the office with them. I saw all of this happening. So I worked for 2CH. So I was parked in the corner of their office with a telephone and a typewriter. And my job was to, I would do reports that you would hear on the radio. I'd tell, you know, the unemployment figures would come out, or the Prime Minister would make an announcement, or there'd be a debate in Parliament. And I would do a report for the news. So the news ran every hour, and every hour we ran 3 or 4 minutes of news, and every bulletin might contain a brief 30, 40 second political story, which would be either me reading a script, voicing it on air, a report, which I would file over the telephone and they would record and then put to air, or I would go to a press conference, record a bit of the Prime Minister or some other politician, and again, I would literally hold the phone over the speaker of the tape recorder and play it down to them. The ABC would have lines installed, but we were very basic then. I was just literally a typewriter and a telephone. But about a year later, they did install a landline, so we were then able to broadcast in higher quality. And they did then get one of the first, I think we got our first computer, very slow telephone modem computer. So,
did I understand you correctly? You were interested in politics long before you...
I became fascinated with politics probably about the time Whitlam was elected in 1972. I'd have been about 9 years old then, and I just remember the excitement of that. And I think teachers were very excited by him as well and probably passed that on to me. My parents hated him. My parents hated Gough Whitlam, so politics diverged. No. Oh, no, I was a member of the party for 2 years when I worked for Simon Crean, but that's just because that was, in a sense, required. It was not essential, but they told you that as I'm working for the Labor Party, you should join. So I joined as a member at large, which means I never attended a branch meeting or voted in anything. I just joined as a... you join the Canberra branch, but you're not eligible to vote in anything. And I never attended a meeting, so I did it. But that's it. No, I never. I was involved in student politics at university in a group that was called Student Unity. This was 1982-83, and it was a group set up to fight what was at university then a very hard left, almost communist influence in student politics, Left Action and groups like that, who were supporting the PLO, supporting the IRA, but mainly, in my view, spending a lot of students' money on things which had nothing to do with students. They were, in a sense, and there was an attempt, you're probably aware, in the 70s, you know, a lot of the big campuses quit the Australian Union of Students in protest at that, and that was Tony Abbott, Peter Costello, people like that. That's where they became involved. In 1982, there was an attempt to have those big campuses rejoin, so there were more ballots, and I was part of the campaign that fought against that. And as a result of that, we formed a political party which took over the Macquarie University Students Council. It was not particularly aligned with any one party. So there were people in that who later went on to join the Liberal Party, people in it who later went on to become prominent members of the Labor Party. So, for example, the leader of our group was Eric Ruzendahl, who later became the Labor Treasurer of New South Wales. Also in it was Gabriel Harrison, who became a minister in the Carr government. But there was also a bloke called Alex Howen who became a vice president of the New South Wales Liberal Party. So the sort of it was the people on it would have been sort of classified as being sort of central, maybe more a bit centre left, but also people on the right. But the main target those days was not Labor Liberal; it was hard left versus everybody else. And that was, you know, one thing that I got involved in. But I was interested in politics, and that was about the time Bob Hawke won the election too. So there was a lot of excitement again about politics, but I was fascinated by it, and it was just my dream to be a journalist and one day hopefully a political journalist, and I got that very quickly.
And you worked for them within that framework of Rod Chalmers inside of Canberra area until 1987.
Yes,
and then you moved to 2GB Macquarie National News.
Their office was directly opposite ours, so about 1 metre away, just in that very narrow corridor. So if you've seen those corridors, I walked across. The reason then was because 2GB Macquarie was owned by Fairfax then, and it was the dominant radio news network in Australia. It was better than the ABC in those days. It employed possibly 100 or more journalists. It had 30 or 40 journalists just in the newsroom in Sydney. It ran current affairs shows. You had Mike Carlton, you had Stephen O'Doherty doing the 12:30 report, Sundown Rundown, all these massive... It was an incredible commitment by a commercial radio station to news and current affairs. But it was also the highest rating station in Sydney. At that stage, it worked. It had John Laws, Mike Carlton, I'm trying to remember some of the others, but it was a... And it was, so it was my dream to work for them because they were doing everything that I wanted to do, working for a music station meant I was filing a little report every hour for the news. Working for 2GB meant you would do much more in-depth reporting.
What was your role within that? I suppose it would have changed over time, but what exactly were you there to do?
Okay, so we 2GB had three journalists in an office which was the size of a broom cupboard. In fact, we could only fit two of us in at any one time. So one person worked early, one person worked in the middle of the day, one at night. If all three happened to be there at the same time, one person had to sit in the corridor because it was the office was not big enough. What we did was we did news stories for the Macquarie National News, which in those days was 2GB, 3AW, Brisbane, Perth, Adelaide, Townsville, Cairns, Canberra, hundreds of little stations. So we covered federal politics, which meant, again, doing those reports, those voice reports, where we might say, well, the Prime Minister today has announced this and so on, Stephen Spencer, Macquarie National News, Canberra, those sorts of reports. But also, if the Prime Minister spoke at a press conference or any other politician, we would file a report that, you know, the newsreader reads the introduction, the Prime Minister today has said this, and then he's done this, and then you play what we call a grab, so the Prime Minister. So we would edit those, file those, write the leads. And that was our main job. But also because they had a commitment to current affairs, we would do sometimes much longer, three-minute type stories, similar to the ones you hear on AM, PM or The World Today, where they're very, go into more depth, talk to more people, have lots more grabs and play those in the shows.
But there were only three of you doing this job.
Yes.
And how did you divide the in a sense, the work? I mean, did you all three turn up for the major events? Or
no, there was a bureau chief, which initially was John Stanley, who's now a radio announcer in Sydney. Then was Tony Allen, who's now, I think, head of regional radio for Victoria. Then I replaced Tony Allen. So the bureau chief would pretty much work from 9 to 5 or 9 to 6, covering the main stories of the middle of the day. Then the other two people would be more junior people who would be rostered on. So they would take it in turns. One would come in at 6 or 7 in the morning to do stuff for the morning of the breakfast news and go to the doorstops when the politicians arrive. And the other person would come in about 2 or 3 in the afternoon and stay till late at night and cover the late news and late sittings of Parliament if they were on. And we generally didn't work weekends unless we knew something significant was happening on a weekend. So it was just three of us covering three shifts, Monday to Friday.
So the areas of coverage that you didn't sort of in advance say you would only specialise in a particular area.
No, you couldn't do that.
You had to do the whole lot.
Yeah, you couldn't do that in radio. It was more... In radio, it's always driven by the times of the day rather than the specialities. Although people might know a bit more about something, so if there was 2 or 3 of you there. I mean, we covered, you had to cover, as you do now, a lot of economics. You might have to cover defence stories. And if there was a big local crime in Canberra, such as the Colin Winchester killing, we would have to cover that because local crime in Canberra would be the job of the local radio station. But if it was a big national story, they would expect us to cover it. We'd go on overseas trips with the Prime Minister. We would travel around the country during federal election campaigns. We would attend, if the US President or the Queen came here, we would cover that. When the Raiders won the Rugby League Grand Final, we went down to the airport to cover that, for example. So we were just considered nearly all politics, 90-95% politics. But if there were big local stories in Canberra, then that was also our job.
What about things like when you, let's say you've been attending an event, you've got written your notes and your paper, so to speak. Was it your work vetted in any sense before you actually went on air?
No, really. I mean, you might... When I was the junior person, the bureau chief might have a quick look at the script and just make suggestions, but usually there wasn't time, and quite often you were the only person in the office. So you had to be... To come into the Canberra Bureau, it was accepted that you couldn't just send somebody down here who had never written a story before. You had to be considered to be a good writer, a self-starter, a person who could cover just about anything. It was a desirable post. A lot of people want to come here. There's always a lot of competition. Anytime the job becomes available, still in television, there will be people from all over the country who will want to come here, if only for 2 or 3 years, because they know the stories are important stories, they're big stories, that they'll get a good run on the news, and they'll also probably do a bit of travel, especially in election campaigns. So you have to be able to do it on your own.
What about the organisation that you, in a sense, worked for? Their editorial policies, did they? I presume they had some policies that operated. How did that influence what you did?
Most of the time, it never did. It was understood that news was news and should not be impacted. by political views. And when I first started, 2CH was just a music station, so it just said everything straight. There was no editorials, no comments. You just reported the news. 2GB, there were comments, and so you then started to have to express opinions and stories about whether things had worked or not. And all the time I was there initially, there was no problems. But eventually there started to become the odd issue where 2GB got taken over by, after Fairfax sold it and it went broke and the whole network, it was in a terrible situation for many, many years where it had no money, no ratings, no stars. And Gordon Moyes and the Wesley Mission picked up the ownership of the station and kept it going for many years at a great loss of money. And he was very close to particularly John Hewson. I think John Hewson, when he was running for the Prime Ministership in 93, had come up with a plan where he was going to outsource large parts of the government to various organisations. You know, he was going to get the Wesley Mission, Salvation Army to run welfare and so on. And so when Moyes became hypersensitive to this and would start complaining about bias in any stories that he heard going to air, which he disagreed with. You know, maybe you were biased or maybe you just didn't agree with his bias, but that was the first time I started to realise, that have pressure put on me. It didn't really affect anything I did. I sort of ignored it because it was understood. The newsroom understood it was independent and would keep playing it straight. Mm-hmm. And I remember asking once to check the complaints and discovered, strangely, that most of the complaints had been Labour people upset about something I'd said. So he heard bias that he thought was against the Liberal Party, but most of the listeners who rang up thought I'd been biased against the Labour Party. Now, the reason was the government was in a lot of trouble then, and so most stories were about the government being in trouble, and if all you do is a story about the government in trouble, people think you're biased, but it might just be the government's in trouble. So that was one occasion. I had a fair bit of pressure at that point, but it was not, it's not nice, but I just sort of carried on, but there was never any threat to sack me or anything, but it was made very clear to me that he thought I was biased and didn't like my reporting, but he didn't seem to be in any position to...
And we're talking about the period while you were at Old Parliament.
So this was it. No, well, this was actually by a new Parliament House. When I was at Old Parliament... So if we're going back to Old Parliament House, no. I mean, half my time there was at 2CH, where there was never an issue just because, as I say, they were a music station.
Time is a component here. I mean, trying to sort of think
certainly up to 88, I had no issues with bias. I mean, I know there were huge issues with bias in the press gallery around that time, because 1987, I mean, it all came to a head. John Howard was leader of the Liberal Party. He was up against Bob Hawke, extremely popular. And I think the press gallery was, I think they'd become very close to Hawke. I think they admired him and Keating immensely. And at the same time, on the Liberal Party side, you had Peacock and Howard constantly undermining each other. Then you had Joe Bjelke-Petersen undermining. So the coalition side was a complete mess. Mm. And the reporting tended to fall into that trap of saying that everything Labor had done was good, everything the coalition had done was bad. And even if the coalition did something good, it was always reported as a brief respite from... So you always still mentioned that things were bad, but they'd... And I remember hearing John Howard himself complaining bitterly about this once. He was particularly critical of the coverage of the ABC and Kerry O'Brien in that election campaign, that he thought that nothing he did was ever reported good, even when it was good. So,
well, that's certainly a question I want to ask you. Generally, would you regard the press gallery as, at that time, being unbiased or biased?
I thought it was biased, but I don't think it was necessarily political that they were pro-Labour or pro-Liberal. I think what happened is you had a government that they thought had done very good work, which I think most historians and politicians today, even the Liberal politicians, would say that was a good government. And so, and at the same time, their opponents were swapping leaders, undermining each other, bitterly divided, and were not therefore regarded as a credible alternative. And Hawke was a very personable, friendly person who made a lot of friends in the press gallery. And I think what happened was a narrative, as they say, developed, and the narrative was it was a good government that was united and working hard, and the opposition was divided and a mess, which they were. So the problem with the narrative is that you then make everything fit the narrative. So even when the government makes a mistake, it might not be reported as well as it should, and even when the opposition does something well, it might not be reported as well as it should. So I think it was just more that the opposition just did not look credible for a very long time, and therefore... yeah, there could well have been journalists who were pro-Liberal and pro-Labor, but it was just simply that the narrative was that one side looked like it was a lot better than the other, and everything was reported. And Gerard Henderson was very, I think, first identified the fact that in the old Parliament House, being very small and everybody living on top of each other, a lot of the senior correspondents would, every afternoon about 4 or 5 o'clock from all the rival organisations, would get together and talk over the day's events. He called it the Rat Pack. And it wasn't that they were saying, well, I'm going to vote Labour today, what are you going to vote? It wasn't quite like that. But they would get together, and all from rival papers, from The Australian, from the tabloids, from Fairfax, people who were supposed to be...
What about yourself?
I was never part of that. You had to be a very senior person to be part of that. So this was not junior radio people. But they would talk over the day's events. And what would happen as a result of them talking over the day's events and discussing things and their opinions is, of course, they would all eventually all come to a similar view. So rather than going off and writing individual stories, you would get a group think where the same general report of the day would appear in lots of rival papers. And it would be a good, well-informed report because they'd all discussed it with each other. But what it did mean was that it tended to all coalesce around the same idea. And Gerard Henderson first identified this, and he first complained about it. And I think he had an impact in that eventually people became more aware that they should be, if they discussing things just with their own paper and not with their rivals.
So that was certainly one of the questions I was going to ask about the relationship between members of the press gallery and whether there was cooperation or did they sort of go in by themselves to get exclusive stories. But from what you're saying, it sounds as if there was kind of cooperation to try to get some...
People would always, if they had an exclusive, they would certainly never share that with anybody. And if they had an idea, people would always keep that to themselves. But it was more the comment pieces every day where people were discussing their opinions. And in the course, if you have a discussion about your opinion with somebody, you will listen to them. You think, oh, that's a good idea, or they might challenge something you said, and you will alter perhaps what you've been saying in the course of that. And when you get a group of people all very intelligent, very well informed, at the top of their game, all discussing these events, it would be a fascinating conversation. But the end result is that they might all end up with saying pretty much the same thing. It might be right, but it was something I noticed. And when he wrote about it, I could see that he had a good point there, I thought.
What was the relationship like between the commercial organisations and the ABC at the time?
The ABC in those days was not very well respected. It had run down its funding for a very long time. It had run down its news facilities for a very long time. It was about the time David Hill, I think, had just become chairman, and he set out to rebuild, to get a lot more money for the ABC in particular. They had closed down a lot of their overseas bureaus. They were not doing a lot of news and current affairs. They had drifted off into the background, and they were not that highly regarded then.
That was a general feeling around the press gallery.
The press gallery. I mean, they had some good people. There were still some very good individual reporters. But their dominant position, which they now have, sort of was starting to be rebuilt around that time. And largely it was because of the Macquarie News Network, I think. The fact that a commercial operator was beating them into news stories, was doing a better job of covering things, had more overseas correspondents, perhaps more journalists, made them work harder to rebuild and become a more respected news organisation. But they, like everybody, had a very tiny room. I think their whole office was about as big as this, and in that would be radio news, radio current affairs. They had a lot of problems with rules and union restrictions. When I first arrived, they were still shooting on film, I think, because there'd been some big dispute about... This was years after everybody else had got video cameras. So they were still shooting on film and developing film, which meant it took them a long time to get things to air. Mm. If a radio reporter recorded a story here, they had to play it down a line to Sydney to have a special editor in Sydney edit their story. Mm. So people weren't allowed to edit their own stories because certain people were reporters, certain people were editors, certain people were producers... So they were very badly restricted in speed and flexibility by the fact they had a lot of rules about who could do what, almost like a building site where one person's allowed to be the plumber and one person's allowed to be the electrician. Now, that changed when we moved up to the new Parliament House. Mm. In a sense, I think they settled it and agreed that the change would happen at New Parliament House, and suddenly they were all using video cameras and cutting their own stories like the rest of us. But they were, it took them forever to do anything in those days because they had to develop the film.
And your focus is still on in this period of time.
This is all in Old Parliament House, yes.
You're on radio, but your focus is
on radio. Yes, yeah. Look, I worked nearly all of my life in radio, and that was, so I was just working in, first of all, for 2CH, then 2GB, about half the time.
Was there any difference between those, you know, the journey in terms of their approach and what happened between the, those who did television coverage and those who focused on radio like you yourself?
Yeah, very different. I mean, in those days, now television is now like 24 hours. We've got bulletins all day, every day in the morning. In those days, there was pretty much only one, which is the 5 o'clock bulletin or the 6 o'clock news. So the TV reporters could spend an entire day chasing the story, getting, you know, like a newspaper reporter, they could spend all day ringing people, talking to people, building the story, and then produce one story, which would go to air. And so they had a great life. I mean, you go on overseas trips with them, and they spent the whole trip sightseeing, going to dinner, having a fabulous time, and then they'd get back late at night and do their story. Now, when television goes overseas, you don't sleep or eat. You just spend the whole time because there's bulletins all the time, particularly the ABC now, you know, the 24-hour news. Whereas before, they had one bulletin at 7 o'clock at night, and that was it.
So there's a really a fundamental difference in the way that the television journalists and those who are based on TV and your own group.
Radio in particular. Radio. Newspaper had obviously no internet, so they would work all day to produce a story late at night that would appear in the paper the next morning, and that was it. Television would work all day to produce a story that would appear at 5 or 6 o'clock, and that was it. Radio, we were on air every hour, every half hour in the morning. So all we did, we didn't often have the chance to really research or go into depth. If the Prime Minister said something, we reported the Prime Minister had said something. If the opposition leader responded, we responded. We reported the opposition leader had responded. We just simply said, this has happened, this has happened, this has happened, this has happened. And we updated it every half hour, every hour. We just kept the story moving with every development across the day, but never much depth or research. We were just constantly keeping people updated all day about what had happened, whereas TV and radio would, TV and newspapers would spend all day trying to find the better story, the new story, the deeper story, the real background.
So your stories would not really be appearing in the newspaper, in the Fairfax newspaper?
Very rarely, unless we broke a big story. I mean, the biggest I can remember we broke was as a journalist who now works for the ABC called Kathy Bolan was working the late shift, and there had been some speculation. This actually might be at New Parliament House. It must have been. But there was some speculation that Peacock might be challenging Howard again in 1989. Mm. And both officers had played it down. And she made some calls very late at night and discovered that, in fact, Peacock had, in fact, just challenged Howard that night. And she reported that story at 10 o'clock on the 2GB news, and the whole place went ballistic because nobody knew it. Mm. Somehow, Peacock's people had kept the secret from every newspaper reporter, everybody in the building had it had kept secret, and one person on radio making one phone call stumbled across the story, and of course then everybody had to follow our story. So occasionally, or we'd have an interview, for example, again a few days later, John Howard, after he'd been dumped, went on John Tingle's radio show on 2GB and told John Tingle that he would not serve with Andrew Peacock's government. So again, that broke. So then everybody had to chase down the interview. And so radio would often do that. But if it did it, it would be more through the fact that the big stars like John Laws. I mean, for example, the Banana Republic comment of the Treasurer, the famous Banana Republic comment about balance of payments. That was an interview that Paul Keating did with John Laws, who was on 2GB at the time. And Keating rang Laws, spoke to him from the kitchen of a place in Melbourne somewhere, on 2GB radio, and then instantly everybody was coming around asking for a copy of the interview. So we had to give them a copy of the interview so that people could listen to what Keating had said and write their stories based on what he had said to John Laws. So that was where it happened, but it was occasionally, but the real, mostly the cycle, the cycle up there then, which is still similar, is that a newspaper would have a big exclusive in the paper, radio repeats that and gets reaction, television repeats that and gets reaction, and then the cycle starts. But occasionally TV breaks stories and radio, but it's usually newspaper, radio, TV is the sort of the pattern of the day.
So
and especially in those days, it was very, very, newspapers had huge staff. huge numbers of journalists, and so they there's lots of people who might spend days or weeks just working on one story, whereas today they've got a file all the time for the internet.
And your focus was has always been on radio.
Yes, I mean, I've been working for TV for the past 6 years. I was asked to be the producer and chief of staff there, but I always loved radio, and I've been in radio in the Parliament for 10, 12, 14 years probably, of all that.
On some more practical and down-to-earth matters, just a bit of the description of your daily, so what life was like working as a journalist
In
Old Parliament House. A typical day.
If it was a typical parliamentary day, or even not a parliamentary day, I'd get in, say, about 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, look at the papers, and maybe file a story over the phone about what was the big story in the newspapers for the radio. They would know because they'd been in since 4, so they might ring me and say, we want you to do this story. And first up, you would pretty much just say what the paper said. You hadn't had a chance to ring anybody. Then you would start chasing reaction. And reaction would usually involve going out to the front of Old Parliament House and waiting for the politicians to arrive and interviewing them as they arrived, and then going back to the office and running those stories, saying what the Prime Minister had said. And the unusual thing at the Old Parliament House was every morning when he was in Canberra, the Prime Minister would arrive at the front of Old Parliament House, walk up the steps and talk to the journalists every morning. There was a what we call the doorstop. Now, at New Parliament House, they drive in through the security entrance, and we never see them unless they call a press conference. But at Old Parliament House, certainly when Parliament was on, and most days, every morning, we would get the Prime Minister, the Opposition Leader, and the Treasurer would stop and talk to us and give us news. And we just waited for them to turn up and talk to us.
So the stories were...